Hello, and welcome to the Ludic Insights podcast. This series explores themes and topics relating to all things digital and digital's impact on our society's leadership and ways of getting things done. My name is Garrick Jones. I'm from the Ludic Group, and I'm a co-author of the book Alive, Digital Humans and Their Organizations, available on Amazon, Kindle, and at all good bookstores near you. I am here with my co-author and fellow business partner, Paul Ashcroft.
Hi there.
And we're delighted to be joined today with Adrian Westaway and with Clara Gagliera Westaway. They are related, but by marriage. The clue is in the names. And we're talking about innovating and inventing for digital humans. And I can't be more pleased to be talking about innovating and inventing with two of my favorite innovators and inventors who I've known for some time, all the way back to Royal College days. And who are really working at the forefront of digital human design and invention. We're going to talk about that. Some of the things you do, the projects you've been involved in. They have a design studio called Special Projects, which is based in the East End of London near Brick Lane. But enough of me talking. Let's say, hand it over to you. Tell us a little bit about yourselves and tell us a little bit about the most exciting projects you guys have been involved in.
Thank you, Garrick. As you said, we run a studio called Special Projects, and our mission is to enhance the unquantifiable aspects of life.
The unquantifiable aspects of life.
Correct. Through meaningful design and inventions. The most interesting projects we have done, it's hard to pick, but we have done a theme park for the 21st century family. We have done a mobile phone user manual. It doesn't sound that exciting, but it is. A planner, a digital and physical planner made out of Lego. Ways of interacting with your phones, like tons of that. The latest one is called Magic UX. Am I forgetting? How many I'm forgetting?
Yeah, it's weird. Our kind of, we picked the studio name to act as a sort of filter. So, you know, of course, we just want to work on really special projects. So we thought if we call the studio Special Projects, people will only approach us.
They will get the idea.
Yeah. And in fact, it's quite funny because most big companies have an actual Special Projects department. So we get, you know, we get approached by them. And it's actually worked really well. But what it means is that most of our projects are completely different. Like, it's such a diverse range. Like Clara mentioned, we've done user manuals for older people using smartphones all the way through to, you know, theme parks. And we had a whole project on softness and lots of things to do with perfume, really like a very wide range of things.
Tell us some of the clients you've been working for, and maybe without identifying some of the things you can't identify, tell us a little bit more in detail about some of these projects.
Sure. So, I mean, I'm kind of trying to think of which one to pick. So we had quite a big project with a global theme park company, which was all about designing a new type of theme park from scratch. And the brief was really amazing. It was all about trying to get kids to do more physical activity. And a lot of theme parks are actually kind of not really designed for getting kids to do any sort of physical activity.
No, they strap you in and then they do stuff to you.
Exactly. And we visited 30 different theme parks. Clara and I went round the world going to all of the...
Jesus. Horrible.
I know. It was, but we also happened to be right when Banksy was doing his Dismaland dystopian theme park in Weston-super-Mare as well. So we really kind of visited a whole range of things. And for us, often it's the really crap ones that are the most interesting because they inspire you, you
Why
know, to do
that?
New things. Well, that's where you kind of get inspired to do things a lot better.
What was crap that inspired you, if I may ask?
Cues.
The food. Well, cues, the food. I mean, the food really, especially, unfortunately, in the ones in America, like after 7 days of nachos at Disneyland, it's just, you know, it's really, you know, it really kind of... makes you go insane.
And also the energy level, like when visiting these amazing theme parks, you see that the parents are actually exhausted and the children are like, you know, maybe happy for the first hour and then crying. So we were really trying to design a place where parents would get their energy back and children can exhaust theirs in a nice way.
And the theme park is an analog thing. And how did you incorporate the digital into to what your solutions were?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I mean, because if you think about it, like you could say, is Uber an analog or a digital thing? You know, your user experience of it is sitting in a car and it's very much like a physical thing, but it's totally underpinned almost invisibly by this sort of digital layer. And that's the same approach we took with this, creating like a sort of invisible layer that nudged you through in a really delightful way, but to the user would just feel purely physical, you know, and not really, you wouldn't really be thinking about apps or things like that.
Can you give
us
an example?
Yeah, I'm trying to think what I can say. So at the moment, this is sort of, is it released?
Yes, of course. Everything's under a special project.
I mean, one thing is very interesting when you kind of look at the dynamic of families before going to a theme park, because there's a huge amount of excitement. You know, if you're kind of a kid and you're about to go to Disney World in like a month's time, like that's so exciting. But if you go to these websites and you try these apps out, they're the most dry and unexciting things you've ever
or
seen.
Or complicated. Disney is a mission in itself to organize your trip to Disney.
It's literally more fun.
You're talking from deep experience.
Deep personal experience.
But it's literally more fun signing up to a bank than it is to setting up to go to most of these theme parks. And you know, why is that the way? And what Clara's mentioning before about, you know, we try and take those little moments, which, you know, functionally these apps and these systems work, but they're not delightful in any way. They don't feel special. So we really take inspiration from that.
So then do you take the online digital experience throughout the physical experience of the theme park?
Exactly, yeah.
In some way.
So you almost don't realize it. Like you could be walking through and just great things are happening to you all the time. Like maybe very good hotels sometimes do this where you don't know how or why, but they just happen to be putting the right thing in front of you at the right time. So it's kind of, but what's interesting with that is, and like all our projects, is that it blends into the other projects we're doing. Some of the findings from that could be really interesting in, say, a hospital setting.
So this is a good question. I was thinking, what have you learned from this project that could be taken into other situations? And you mentioned hospitals. What kind of things have you learned there?
From this project and from other projects that we've learned that technology really needs to take a backseat. So we're a firm believer in calm technology. So we believe that technology should work in the background for humans to have a frictionless, beautiful experience that they can really enjoy. It's not the case right now. Like you see many humans walking around with a phone in their hand and almost being like...
So you have people walking into each other, walking into walls, walking into lampposts, because all they're doing is walking in the world, but they've...
It's not integrated, is
no.
it?
No.
It's not integrated. It's not helping you leave.
Do you have some clues for where that might be going in the future? What could replace that?
It's interesting, like, because we studied industrial design together. That's where we met at the Royal College of Art. And iPhones had just come out, I think, when we graduated. And we take a very kind of physical industrial design approach to solving digital problems. And often, you know, we find that and our general approach to these things is even though we may be asked to make an app, we'll think about it very much in terms of the real world and what's going on. And it feels like people are dialing back now from using their phones for too many things. So just 4 years ago, it was all about dashboards and data everywhere. Whereas now, a good app is one that you use the least. You know, you barely use.
And it harvests the most data.
It probably does. That's absolutely true. But I feel like there definitely is a backlash. And you're seeing products like the Light Phone and kind of a whole feast of kind of calm technology coming out, which is all about spending more time doing stuff in the real world and less time kind of fiddling with the screen.
Yeah, we seem to be figuring out gradually how to integrate the digital technology in our lives. The analogy I gave earlier today was we've been sort of drinking from the fire hose of information, apps, things that we can play with like a new shiny toy, and have sort of forgotten about all the other things going on in our real lives. It's a pretty sad state of affairs where, you know, your wife or your partner or your children can even say to you, yeah, you spend more time with your phone than you do with me.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's a world that we want to live in.
Yeah. And it's totally true. And you can, like, when you think of televisions and things, when they first came out, they were designed as pieces of furniture to, you know, to integrate into your house. And that's sort of coming back now. Like, you know, some of the most popular TVs are things like the Samsung one that looks like a picture frame. And they're almost, their selling point is that, look, they disappear. You don't have to think about tech for some part of your day. And you see that a lot with, you know, a lot of IKEA's now integrating, you know, charging in secretly into all of its sort of pieces of furniture. So you can just put your phone on the table and it will just start charging. And if IKEA's doing that, you know, that's a really kind of
massive. There goes the neighborhood.
Yeah. but it definitely feels like the way things are going.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to The Alive, Digital Humans and Their Organizations podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast and explore previous episodes on iTunes, Spotify, and all major podcast hosting sites. Search Ludic Insights.
So you guys are involved often in being asked to dream 4 or 5 years in the future, sometimes more than that. And you use one of your design processes to get there. Tell us a little bit about what you've learned from all of this, and what you would advise people who are preparing for, you know, the next 4 to 5 years. Think about it another way. You have a kid together. What kind of world are you preparing?
Yeah, this is a loaded question. I feel is so the methodology that we use is really centered around the end user. You know, so we like to involve the end user at the beginning of the project and really treat them as muses. So we don't really we also do focus group at the end when we have a product, but we believe that the real input happens before we design, before we even have an idea, when we are investigating the problems. And at that point, we involve different users and literally we look at them for inspiration. So I guess we always try to improve their experience. So our goal is really to improve people's life. I know it sounds like, hopefully this is the goal of any design studio. But, but we're really driven by that. So I feel that we're trying to create a better world for our daughter. I don't know if we're going to make it in 5 years' time, but every invention that we do is trying to enhance the you know, empathy, well-being, delight, all these aspects that very often are neglected when designing, when innovating with new technologies. You know, like efficiency and speed are often measurable and valued, but we really try to look also at the other aspects.
So here's a question then: what are the if speed and efficiency betray a previous epoch? What do you think are the values and the things we should be putting into our designs for the world going future?
Empathy, communication, you know, all the things that unfortunately technology risks to take us apart and risk to create a world that is just for us. You know, look at the, you know, all the scandals around Facebook and Cambridge Analytica.
And your plea is for the values to be much more about empathy and collaboration, being together, and
I sound a bit like a fairy, but I
not
think
at all. I mean, God almighty, no. I think. Thank God, some designers are thinking that way.
It's been quite a theme from as we talk to more people about using digital technology. I think you guys have put it really clearly about technology in the background, and if you use that as a starting point, that it's an enabler, it's something that just is there. Then the imagination can go anywhere, but you're focused on what's the human outcomes and what's the human experience you're designing for, seems like.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, when the whole kind of buzzword of Internet of Things came out, a lot of companies were coming to us just saying, you know, we make product X, how can we make it internet connected? You know, and that was like
their brief,
which is sort of like the worst brief ever, because there was no reason to connect these. I'm not going to say what these things are, but really it was all sorts of things, you know, like connecting anything to the internet.
Do I really need to switch my washing machine on from, you know, the other side of the world?
Exactly.
Because I can't even load it because I'm not there to put clothes
in it. Wait, this is a great idea. I'm going to write this down. A lot of the time we have to kind of like convince them that we should be spending our time looking for problems to solve rather than just sticking tech on top of some object.
Yeah.
So I think what we try and do is really spend the time to find a real problem that really does need solving, and then you know, spend a huge amount of time and detail to kind of solve that in the most delightful way.
I do have a friend who has an app on his phone that can switch on his kettle from wherever he is in the world and tell him how much water there might be in it, and also the temperature that it might be in at any point, anywhere. Be useful.
Doesn't sound like a problem that needs solving.
No, it doesn't.
Because
does
you still need to be there to put water in the kettle.
You still need to be there to drink the tea. I know. But, you know, it's nice to know we can do these kinds of things.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
but maybe those are the kind of excesses of, like, it's the beginning of a new something and we're all experimenting and so on. Wait, what are some of the things that we are learning that you think that signpost where things are going?
Well, hopefully, I think for us that we've always been, as Clara mentioned, we've always been advocates of calm technology, and you know, some people kind of call it, you know, minimalism. And when you look at things like Marie Kondo and the sort of impact that's had on people, like her book and the Netflix series, I think
this
we are
is the lady who says if it doesn't give you joy, throw it out.
Yeah, well, I feel like the mainstream are kind of beginning to like embrace this way of thinking, and I think that's beginning to sort of happen to digital things too.
Yeah, things, you know, becoming embedded
and just simpler, and you know, just they just do the thing they're meant to do, and that's it, and you put them away. And so I guess like a sort of digital minimalism in a way, as we call it, calm, you know, calm technology. And this is actually based on a very famous research paper by Mark Weiser in the 90s from Xerox PARC, who, you know, way before smartphones and everything, predicted this moment that we're now in, where there would be just so much digital clutter, you know, eating away every piece of our attention. So we've done a lot of work on sort of digital well-being, and we'll be releasing a new project in a couple of months. But that's been really interesting for us, looking at the research and the workarounds that people do to try and not be distracted digitally. Things like making their phones black and white so that they don't look as appealing. And all these kind of things that sound kind of quite weird and quite funny, but actually do work.
Mm.
So I think that's what we're quite inspired by. And I think we're beginning to see more and more.
Where do you get your inspiration? And one of the things that we've been exploring and talking about is curiosity. So how does curiosity play a role in your work? And where do you go to seek inspiration if you're not just solving a problem that doesn't exist, but you're actually trying to inspire yourselves to really think about how things should be in the future?
I think curiosity is the number one ingredient for any inventor or innovator. Like, I think if you're not curious and if you're not looking around, you're never gonna even, you know, ask yourself a question, could this be better? And where do we go to find our inspiration? At least for myself, I think I just literally walk around. I mean, people are my inspiration, and frustration. I love frustrations. When there is a frustration, it means there is a problem to solve. And you know, I believe that particularly if a product or a tech product even more is frustrating someone, it means the design is not right. So there is an opportunity there to solve it. So yes, I think people, you know, London is a great place. There are lots of people, but anywhere
lots
in
of
the
frustrated
world.
People.
Lots of frustrated people.
It's funny because we were talking about this earlier with Clara, like, you know, you kind of think of frustrations as a sort of pessimism and, you know, people who kind of get pessimistic about stuff, but you know, you kind of literally see Clara's eyes light up if something's not working, because, you know, that's something that we could kind of try and fix in some way. So it's like optimistic pessimism in a way.
What do you think we need to pay attention to as human beings moving forward?
Your data.
Your data?
Yes.
Tell us more.
I think up to now we've given our data and our information to huge technology company without even really realizing what we were sharing. And now governments and consumers should really regulate these share of data. You know, it's fine if you decide you want to give your data to a company, but then you have to understand what the deal is, what you're receiving in return, what you're giving, much more clearly. I think right now it's all very muddy and unclear, and your data is your property, I believe, so you should really understand what's happening with those.
As much, yeah, if you think if somebody steals your wallet, it's very easy to just go to the police and kind of explain it and kind of get it fixed in some way, but how, you know, how would you even begin to do that sort of digitally?
Can you imagine there would be a simple data contract that you make?
Well, There are. I saw an experiment just the other day, which is like an AI kind of bot that will read the sort of legal terms and conditions that you often get when you sign up to something, and then translate them for you in the way that you understand, so you can kind of ask it questions. So it's almost like this middle
plain English.
Yeah, in
plain
a way,
English,
yeah,
like, app.
Exactly. Yeah, but I think it is really interesting, and you can imagine. You know, there are apps that automatically get refunds for you if your train is late and stuff. They kind of take care of these things. You can kind of imagine things kind of going in that way.
That becomes more interesting when the apps start to
act on your behalf.
Act on your behalf, because we all know how difficult it is as an individual up against, say, the institutions of law and very large corporates. It's almost impossible sometimes to think of people who're missing out on their holidays because of the collapse of, say, Thomas Cook or something. Getting the money back is their right in law, but it's not going to be easy. You know, can you imagine having apps and things which kind of do those things on our behalf?
Can I ask about adoption? So one of the things that...
Of children?
No. A digital adoption of new services or new products... In the past, perhaps, and maybe even still today, big companies would say, getting our people to use this new technology, or we want our customers to now start using this new way of doing things. It's quite difficult. What have you learned in terms of getting people actually using the technology or using the services that you've been designing?
I think one of our earliest and probably most known project is all about enabling less tech-savvy people to use smartphones. And this was done in 2010, so a long time ago. And we felt that ideally using a familiar mental model could help. So in our case, we used a book, really, a hardbound book, to explain to less tech-savvy people, older people, how to use a smartphone. And we literally cut out pieces of the pages to reveal the elements of the phone one by one as the user would turn the page. So I think the person knows how to use a book and therefore will understand how to use an alien
object. So you were making
that
bridge
object.
For them between
Correct.
The two things.
Using a familiar mental model.
Yeah, taking the time to figure out what their mental model was and then kind of using that to help bridge the gap. And we've used that approach quite a lot. I think you can only do that if you take the time to understand, you know, what's going on in their head before they kind of start using this.
And if you respect and value the human at the center of these things.
Yeah, yeah. And it takes time. And I think some companies are scared of doing it. They feel like they already know what the problem is and they don't need to do more research, but it's essential, really.
We've tried similar approaches when we've been innovating services ourselves. So if we invent a new app for people to work together, we realised you can't change context and content at the same time. So if, for example, you ask them to move a way of working into a digital way of working, you need to give them the same way of working. So, for example, if they're used to using pens and paper to build a process flow or to do a plan... Give them the things that look like pens and paper and use that in the digital technology. So they can use exactly the same way of working, but then apply that online.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So we just sort of patented a new invention that we sort of came up with ourselves in the studio, which is kind of in a similar way. It's all about multitasking on a smartphone. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever tried to kind of copy and paste an article from your browser into an email on your phone, you know, it takes quite a bit of time. You have to, you know, phone's a bit like a pack of cards. You can only really have one card on top. And it's a bit of a hassle, you know, to copy and paste in between apps. So we basically, in the same way to what you were saying, Paul, like we were looking at how people move between tasks on a desk. It's very easy to have a notepad and a calculator and sort of move between them by just shifting your gaze and moving your hands. And we basically made an app where you just move the phone left and right, and it basically allows you to pin apps in the space around the phone.
Oh, that's clever.
And then you can literally drag and drop and move content around. And it's a very kind of simple analogy, but it's something that is quite universal.
People are familiar
understand.
With already.
Yeah.
And you're connecting physical with digital.
Exactly, yeah. And for us, it kind of struck all the the sort of values we try and have in all our projects, because it's a very kind of quite a magical experience, but it's very functional too.
So I want to ask you, you've used two interesting analogies there. One, you've been talking about a pack of cards and you just referred to being magical. Full disclosure, we know that you have some connection with magic yourself. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, and does that in some way play a role in the work that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been a magician since I was 11 years old, and I'm a member of the Magic Circle here in London. And I'm just obsessed with sort of magic and doing tricks and all sorts of different types of tricks. And it wasn't until I started studying design and started working on projects that I started to realize that there was quite a strong link between the two, because magicians are essentially experienced designers, and they have tricks up their sleeves. There's all sorts of things they use, magnets and wires, all the things. You're right. There's all sorts of technology that they have at their disposal, but their job is to make that technology completely disappear and make their audience experience something else. So as designers, we work with all these big tech companies. They come to us and give us all sorts of really amazing things and gadgets, but our job is to make that completely disappear and create an experience for somebody that potentially has nothing to do with that technology at all. So there's a lot of moving in front and behind the curtain in a way, and it's very important for us as designers to realize that we should really be focusing only on the experience somebody will have and not getting bogged down on the technology that enables it to happen.
I love it, because we've been talking about the human and keeping the human at the center of things. We've been talking about how technology is disappearing and sort of it'll be around us, but it'll be much more built into everything we experience. But here you're talking about the magic and the things that inspire and the things that kind of make life fun and worth living and get us all worked up and smiling. And it's that which I want you to talk a little bit more about.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, because when we say we use magic in design, often, some companies will come to us and they'll often want us to do quite gimmicky things, like a levitating Bluetooth speaker. That actually already exists.
I think you gave me a Christmas present.
Well, it's an interesting object. But there are these things that are, you could say, are magical, but are immediately quite gimmicky and kind of will not be very magical in a few days' time. And of course, the problem is when you're designing a product that's magical, you're giving the whole apparatus to someone and they can make that trick happen hundreds of times, and it immediately kind of gets boring and not magical. And what we try and do is to create really delightful magical moments, which are anchored in a real problem that needs solving. And I think one good example of this, something that we've done, is the Apple power connector for your laptops, the magnetic one that they used to have on all their laptops. And for us, that's such a magical little invention. It's so delightful. And it's completely, you don't even think about it most of the time.
But the fact it's magnetic just makes it work.
Exactly.
And safer.
And the minute you trip over, the day you trip over that cable and it happens, for a second you freak out, you turn around and you realize, thank God for this little thing. And I think that's such a beautifully, well thought out magical moment, which only exists for a very short period of time.
Unlike the current version where you have to struggle to get the thing in one of the four things.
Yeah, we need to talk to them about that. Yeah.
That's right.
But I think
the USB-C is a nice move in the same direction.
But I think for us, if you imagine a scale of astonishment, most magicians try and create miracles and real, wonder and awe, making the Statue of Liberty disappear. We're quite content with little moments of delight, because they create a really strong and emotional connection to that experience. So we try and use magic in that little way, like a little bit of magic dust on top of what we're doing. But we never want it to be perceived as a gimmick. We always want it to be sort of anchored in some sort of functional use.
You're listening to The Alive, Digital Humans and Their Organizations podcast. Discover and download previous episodes on iTunes, Spotify, and all major podcast hosting sites. Search Ludic Insights.
Well, we've actually brought a little trick along with us, if you have the time
Speaking of magic.
It's something we designed because we wanted to create a trick we could post out to people that we wouldn't be able to see in person.
So you brought a sort of large envelope in, and if you open that envelope, inside is a sort of a book, and it's a cardboard book, and it has a picture of... It has a picture of a card and a finger on the front. Can I read it?
Yeah, you can read it. I mean, if you want, I'll read it out to you, and then please, and then you can try. So yeah, there are four little cards held in this envelope, and it says, "Clear your mind," and in a second, you're going to put your finger on one of these four cards.
Yes.
So it's free choice.
All right.
So just clear your mind, Garrick, and put your finger on one of them.
All right. Done.
Okay, now slide the card into the little holder.
So I need to describe what Adrian has given me. It's like a card, a very large Christmas card. And when you open it, it has an image of a finger and it has four cards in it. And I have to, with my finger, slide one of these cards into the pocket at the top of the page. So this is incorporating magic into design.
Exactly. And it really is a free choice. So genuinely just there are four different cards. Just pick one and slide it in.
I know, but you're such a magician. You've probably suggested something in the last, like, hour and a half since we've been talking. All right, I'm going to do this one. And now I have to slide it. It's sliding. And I'm putting it into the little pocket at the top, like that. That's very nice. Is that enough? Does it need to go in?
That's it. Perfect.
Like that. Right. Now what?
Turn the page.
Now I turn the page. Right, the page is turned. Right, my chosen card. Yes, so I can see what I've chosen. This is like that trick that magicians do, except it's being done not by Adrian, it's being done by a piece of design. And then there's an envelope, and inside it says, please open this envelope to see our prediction. And if I open that envelope, it says, you chose the Queen of Hearts, which of course... I did. That's absolutely phenomenal. I don't want to swear, but how on earth? Normally, this is done by a magician. Okay, so how on earth do you do that?
Well, I mean, it's yours to keep, Garrick.
And well, that's very kind.
The interesting thing is that some people often will never open it again and choose to never look at it again.
No,
they don't
want
to know.
I want
Others
to
take it to pieces.
Do you need to teach me something so that I can... I can use this on Paul on many occasions.
After this, yeah, I'll quickly show you and then you can try it.
That's just
Paul.
Absolutely remarkable. Look at that time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So now what you've done is you've industrialized or automated a magic trick.
It's kind of an experiment for us because when you make a product magical, it doesn't happen that way with magic tricks that you see on TV. It's always the magician who's doing the tricks.
Yes.
Whereas you're putting it into someone's hands. And that's kind of a weird sort of dynamic that you don't normally get. So it was a kind of quite an interesting experiment. And we were really surprised because a lot of people didn't want to know the secret and they would close it and they'd email us and say, I don't know how you did this. I'm not going to touch it for a week. I don't want to know the secret.
I can tell you right now, I don't want to know how you do it.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Are we going to leave it at that?
I'll take it home.
Please. Well, no. I'll keep it unless you want to, Paul.
Maybe, yes.
You can tell Paul the secret and then he can do it with his
son
Ben.
So I have a question. What is, you guys are used to challenging the status quo and making people think differently. Is there one thing that you could think of that you hold true that other people will completely disagree with you on?
Yeah, I mean, there's one thing that really bugs me, and it's an Arthur C. Clarke quote that we always kind of hear because we work in technology and magic. You know, people always email and say, oh, there's this great quote. And it's, he says, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. It's quite a famous quote. And you often see it at tech conferences. And I actually, you know, I think like as a studio, we couldn't disagree more. I mean, Arthur C. Clarke was amazing. It's just taking the quote literally in that way is totally wrong. It basically says if you have an amazingly advanced technology, it will immediately be magical. But that's not true at all because the magic isn't in the technology. The magic is sort of in the experience that someone has with that technology. So for us, we always kind of rip it to pieces when we talk to tech companies because they often think, you know, great, we've got some new tech. It's immediately going to be magical. And you have to do a lot more work before you can make something feel magical.
Yeah,
so that one bugs me.
I like that one. Clara, do you have one?
The lack of decoration is something that not many people agree with me on. But
is that because you want no decoration or you want loads more?
And I want no decoration. I feel that they're all, like, I think that good design is timeless. And also, you know, from an environmental perspective, if we design something that is not going to look out of place in 6 months or a year, we're doing a better job. So I feel that decoration gives a certain era or a certain moment to design. While if you take decorations away and you literally try and do something as timeless and as essential as possible, you make it resist time and place. But yes, no. Now I see that our clients are interested in this more and more, but definitely it's been something I've been fighting for in the past 10 years.
So something about making it timeless, simple and making it timeless, and something about get over technology. It's not magic in and of itself. Very nice. I like those two. A final question, if I may. What would be your advice or your recommendations for designing for digital humans in the future?
I think design for humans, like, don't worry too much about the digital part when you're doing the designing. Think about the real problems that they're facing. And don't worry about it being digital or physical, what it is at the moment that you're designing, because you're trying to sort of solve a human problem at the end of the day. And technology might not always be the answer. It's okay if it's only 20% of the answer or 1% or zero. So I think for us, you know, when we start a project, we never know if it's going to end up being digital or physical or increasingly a bit of both. And I think that seems to work really well for us.
Be open to it.
Yeah.
I love that answer because it reminds me of Aikido, you know, the martial art where they teach you how to redirect energy and not necessarily direct the energy back at your opponent, but, you know, take the energy and send them on their way. And in Aikido, a viable and legitimate option is to run away.
That's amazing. Yeah, don't be scared to run away. But we're going to run away now.
Well, before you do, Clara, do you have advice for designing for digital humans or for humans in a digital world?
I definitely agree with what Adrian said. You know, the technology is a medium. Physical solutions are a medium, so just be open to use either and solve the problem. And I guess for companies is allow your departments to cross-pollinate, you know, don't decide that the digital department is going to solve these and the product department is going to solve that, but really look at the problem and then see which department is the best one or what is the solution.
And foster collaboration.
Correct.
Between the different ones, yeah. Very nice. Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Such
both.
A pleasure.
Thanks.
Now we're going to spend the rest of the afternight
figuring out the magic tricks.
How
it's
you do
Paul's
that.
Turn now. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, you have to tell him because I know Ben would love to see it, wouldn't he? Incredible.
It's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
See you
soon.